qualifying, quantifying, and meeting the challenge of internet access cost. This is a workshop regarding access. I have the honor to be here and heavy responsibility to make sure all our speakers have time to inform you of their views and that you have time to comment and express your views within the next 1 hour and a half. You have a brochure which provides more information about our speakers and the organizing associations, iGrowth, the GIIC, WITER, PCH, and Keidanren. I think it is fair to say that the organizing associations see access to the information infrastructure and the internet as one of the most fundamental measures of a society's ability to grow its economy, enhance its social well-being, and integrate itself with the global economy. In the past, we have learned that the private sector is an important driver in the development of the information infrastructure because it brings private capital, technological innovations, and job creation. Governments also play a key role in facilitating the rapid build-out of a harmonized, interconnected information infrastructure through a high-level commitment and attention to its expansion. Multilateral institutions provide a forum like this Internet Governance Forum for coordinating government action and international cooperation on matters relating to global development. During our workshop, particular attention will be paid to the three issues. You have those in your brochures, and I'd like to repeat quickly. One, the role of international, regional, and domestic peering and transit agreements as a component of overall connectivity cost. Two, the proper role of regulation and competition in lowering end-to-end connectivity costs. And three, the identification of various best practice initiatives, such as construction of internet exchange points, capacity building in skills and expertise that internet service providers, governmental officials, and other stakeholders have used in local, national, and regional communities to boost internet penetration rates, particularly in Africa and Latin America. We will start with a few opening remarks on the importance of broadening internet access from my side. Mr. Kiyoshi Mori, Japan's Vice Minister for Policy Coordination, and Dr. Alfredo Abudo El Monsef, Vice President, National Telecommunications Regulatory Authority of Egypt. And then we will hear from two experts involved with internet service providers, Mr. Bill Woodcock and Mr. Nishar Gobahan, who will speak of various practices that are successfully being used to increase internet access in emerging economies, as well as some that are unnecessarily discouraging more widespread use of the internet. Ambassador David Gross, U.S. Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy, will join us later as he's just arriving at the airport this morning. After these remarks, we will ask our audience for comments and questions. So now, I'd like to ask Vice Minister Mori for your remarks. Mr. Mori, please.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Kato-san. It is my great pleasure to have this opportunity of making my presentation in this workshop. I'll explain Japanese present situation in broadband. Let me first explain the current status of the broadband market in Japan. Looking at the number of broadband subscribers, about 26.4 million households are now enjoying broadband services in Japan. DSL subscribers accounts for about 14 million. A particular point to notice is the fact that the number of DSL subscribers has begun to decrease. Instead, the number of subscribers to optical fiber has started to increase very rapidly. Along with this broadband service development, an ITU survey concludes that Japan is now ranked first with regard to price and speed of broadband services. This is the trend in the number of mobile phone subscribers. Internet access accounts for 87% of the total mobile phone market. Third generation mobile, which is IMT 2000 users who can enjoy high speed data link are about 72% of the total users. There are two main factors behind the rapid development of broadband internet connection in Japan. The first is the government-led ICT strategy. And the second is the introduction of aggressive competition policy. As you see this seat, the eJapan strategy was promoted by the Japanese government from 2001 and 2005. And also, eJapan policy started from 2006 and going to 2010. The concept of the eJapan policy is ubiquitous network society, which means the society is connected to anyone on anything, anytime, and anywhere. These are the several examples of positive results of the eJapan strategy. The charge was reduced to one-third of the initial level. More than 70% of public schools have created and uploaded their own websites on the internet, etc. This is the summary of eJapan policy, which started 2006. First, there are three main policies. The first is to prepare broadband infrastructure on a nationwide basis. The second point is to upgrade the usage of ICT to solve the problem that our society faces. The third point is improvement of the environment for ICT usage. Safety and security of ICT are the preconditions for the steady and sure transition to the ubiquitous society. The ICT industry has made and is still making an enormous contribution to Japan's national economy as a whole. The contribution by the ICT industry to the real GDP growth in Japan in 2005 was estimated to be more than 40% of the total industries. This is the reason why ICT development is so important. In this way, the advancement of internet usage has exerted a positive influence on people's lives and industries in Japan. But there are some critical issues to be tackled urgently. I think top three priorities are as shown on the slide. The first is the issue of responding to the increased traffic. As a result of the diffusion of broadband connection, the traffic volume on the internet has increased dramatically. This graph shows that an estimated average of 721.7 gigabits of traffic was flowing on the internet as of May 2007 in Japan. The ratio of increase is 2 times for the 2-year period. Other important facts were also found. First, as a result of the increase in the installation of optical fiber networks, the traffic, especially upstream traffic, has been increasing very rapidly instead of easing the traffic. Second, heavy users who account for only 1% of total users are occupying as much as 60% of the traffic. The third, they constitute mainly peer-to-peer data flow. Consequently, in order to cope with such an increasing and congested traffic, the Japanese government is now conducting the study of establishing the guidelines for the packet shaping. In addition, experiments are ongoing of efficient usage of peer-to-peer technology to disperse traffic. The problem of who should pay and what amount to pay for the usage of network is still under discussion. This is the problem of this issue of network neutrality, so-called network neutrality. The second issue is freedom to choose networks. In the age of the next generation network, NGN, which is to provide the new network service fully equipped with IP technology, we have to examine policy frameworks toward enabling the development of services that will satisfy the needs of users by allowing them to select various functions and applications to use the network. The third challenge concerns with the safe and secure usage of the internet. The Japanese government has been implementing measures pillared by the 3 points. The first is reinforcement of the network, securing of reliability, such as countermeasures against cyber attacks. The second is improvement of human capability for security control. And the third, response to diversification of goods and services capable of being connected to the networks. This may include the IPv6 issue. In concluding, may I assume that some of these issues on which debate and discussions are being carried out in Japan are the same issues that your countries are faced with now or are going to face in the future. All of us would therefore have much to consider and do in the coming years. In the hope that today's discussion will become part of the building blocks of our mutual future development of the internet around the world, I would like to conclude my presentation. May I extend my deepest appreciation to the host of this workshop for giving me this opportunity to address to this most distinguished audience. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mori. I'm sure you know many people really appreciate the success of Japan's broadband penetration at a very low cost. Now we'd like to turn to Egyptian perspective. Now I'd like to ask Dr. Elmonsef, who is a vice president of National Telecommunication Registry Authority of Egypt. Monsef, you have a floor.
Good morning to you. Uh, and good morning to you all. We were told today that I will have more time to speak about digital experiment. So what I did, I put together some notes. Yesterday I was counting on just talking, but I put together some notes. Maybe it will help introduce the experience of Egypt. The policy for introducing broadband in Egypt and in liberalizing the telecom sector in general and developing the telecom sector actually went on parallel axes. The regulatory environment and infrastructure development is one of the main interests and the main achievements that we have done. Universal access and ICT national initiatives, and I will just talk a little bit about the future. On the regulatory environment infrastructure development, what we've done, first I represent the National Regulatory Authority in Egypt, and we started the liberalization of the telecom sector in 1998. It has been always based on a private-public partnership, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the status of the network. The liberalization of the telecom sector started in 1998, as I said, and we started with two mobile operators, private sector mobile operators, with the incumbent fixed network operator. And then we worked on the data operators, private sector operators, and what's remaining in the liberalization process, now we have liberalized the international and cable landing stations. What is remaining is the liberalization of the fixed networks, and it's going to be done in the next few months. The present status in the fixed network, we have about 11 million subscribers. Mobile operators, we have 27.7 million subscribers, and the population of Egypt is about 76 million. Internet and data service providers, we have a multiple competition structure actually providing infrastructure service provision and internet service provider virtual operators. The international gateways and cable landing, we have started this year liberalization of the international gateways. Now the mobile operators have international access, that they have the possibility of providing international access, and we allowed many cable operators to land in Egypt, not only the incumbent operator as it was before. Universal access. So developing the infrastructure was one of the major tasks, and allowing competition in the infrastructure, providing diversity in the access was the first step. And then again, the second step is universal access policy to improve accessibility to these infrastructures. I just have to say that also the mobile operators are now providing 3G services. So three of them have license for 3G operations based on UMTS, introducing, of course, access to internet and applications, media applications, and so on. A universal service program, the objective, of course, is the coverage of the remote and underserved areas and the increased penetration for covered areas, also public access, pay phones and telecenters, and making this access affordable. I will just talk about each of these when we're speaking on the ICT national initiatives. Now I will concentrate, this was just a quick introduction to the status of the telecom sector in Egypt. I will talk about the ICT national initiatives. We have taken some important steps on the way to ensure, to increase the penetration of broadband and internet accessibility. I just have to say that in Egypt, there are many barriers to internet accessibility. The language is one of them, education level is one of them, the penetration rates are one of them. First initiative was Free Internet Initiative. It was followed by PC to Every Home Initiative, IT Clubs Initiative, and Broadband Initiative. The Free Internet Initiative, the objective, introduction and awareness and availability of the internet nationwide, paving the road for broadband nationwide. So just getting the users to be used to access the internet and to have minimum access bandwidths to be able to send email, to browse the internet, and so forth. And this initiative was launched in January 2002. The Free Internet Initiative model is based on a subscription-free internet service. Every phone owner is eligible for this service. So using the subscription of the fixed line to have free internet at the rate of the, or at the cost of the local phone call only. And the cost of the local phone call is two piastres per minute, which makes 1.25 Egyptian pounds per hour, which is about $0.2 per hour. So it's a very affordable price to start with. We had a special numbering prefix 0777 or 0707 to access the internet via dial-up. And of course, many entities helped working on this initiative. The public-private partnership was used to the maximum in this case. The Ministry of Communication and Information Society, the regulator, and the telecom operator, the incumbent telecom operator, Telecom Egypt, together with the local private sector ISPs, provided this, made the bandwidth available, made the initiative available. We used also the Telecom Egypt subscription as a guarantee to the payment of the access to the internet. The bill was collected with the regular telephone bills from the incumbent, by the incumbent operator. The model was based on offloading and revenue sharing mechanism between the incumbent operator and the private data operators. This increased, of course, to increase the competition. It helped improve the quality of service and reduce a reduction of the cost and the utilization growth. So this was the first step. The second step that followed was to provide a PC that is affordable. And there was an initiative called PC for Every Home. The objective is to provide affordable, high quality local brand PCs to users. And the initiative started in December 2002. It is followed by phase two, called Egypt 2010, Nation Online Initiative. PC for Every Home model, again, it's a private, public-private partnership. The Ministry of Communication and Information Technology and the Telecom Egypt and the Misr Bank, which is the main national bank in Egypt, local private sector companies have all shared roles in providing this initiative. Every phone owner, again, is eligible, paid on a monthly installment. So the price of the PC is paid on installments monthly. With the phone bill, and people pay about $15 to $20 per month, which is very affordable, financed by the banking sector in Egypt. The suppliers accredited and sampled, approved by MCIT for the PCs. Market stimulation arises internet in local manufacturing. Second axis is the IT clubs. In area where people don't have private telephones, again, it is a sort of universal service access. The objective was to introduce awareness and availability of the internet nationwide in least developed areas where people don't have their own telephones. It started in 2002. Again, it's based on public-private partnerships with civil society, NGOs helped providing the place, the Ministry of Telecommunication helped providing the equipment, and then people started to pay for the internet user in a very nice business model, actually. After that, the broadband initiative. When we opened the competition in the networks and we enhanced the infrastructures, we have three mobile operators providing 3G. We're looking at introduction of second fixed, and it was about time to increase broadband penetration or to help going in this direction and promoting higher speed connections, paving the road to e-content market and to Egypt Information Society. And this initiative was, was launched in May 2004. The broadband initiative model. partial local loop unbundling. So we succeeded in doing this with the incumbent operator by a line sharing model in the second quarter of 2002. Yet there is a very low number of broadband subscribers in Egypt as a total number. But the growth is amazing because when we started, it was a really very low number, and then MCIT and TRA with the Telecom Egypt and the local private sector ISPs were negotiating with the cable operators to lower the prices. And then again, from the Universal Service Fund, we tried to help subsidize the transmission prices for the rural areas from the Universal Service Fund to be able to provide DSL, broadband connectivity everywhere in Egypt at an affordable price. So a price reduction, effective rollout, and effective end-user installation, in addition to a nationwide brandless marketing campaign. And we arrived today to a number of about 335,000 DSL subscribers. The number is low as it is, but the growth is amazing because of this policy, and we're hoping, of course, for more. Promoting in the ADSL higher speed by getting their prices down. Currently, the 256 kilobits per second costs 95 Egyptian pounds per month over limited packages that start as low as 45 Egyptian pounds per month. The present status, the internet number of internet users overall is 7.7 million subscribers or users. The international bandwidth is about 15 gigabits per second. ADSL subscribers, as I said, 355,000. PC sale within the initiative, only within the initiative, 155,000 PC. And the number of IT clubs is about 1,550 nationwide. The future, again, working on the same axis that we have, developing of local content is one of the targets that we're working on, providing applications such that e-education, e-government, making these applications interesting to people to solve problems in rural areas or even in crowded places and do a lot of e-government transactions online. One of the objectives of getting aboard new subscribers, peering on hosting, as I said, we opened the competition in the cable landing and the international gateways, and we're trying to work on the peering and hosting to make Egypt a hub for Africa and for the region. And people are very interested. We already have, the industry has shown a lot of interest in this. Again, one of the most important issues that will direct the growth of broadband in the future is convergence of network and services, the effect of telecom media convergence on penetration rates. The new class of subscribers can be connected to broadband internet because of triple play that will be provided to users, which will promote the introduction of broadband to a larger portion of the population. Again, opening the competition in the fixed line networks is one of the main things on the agenda now. We are announcing an RFP for this by the beginning of 2008, so we're working on this for the time being. So this is about the Egyptian experience in as a resume. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. El Monsef. I'm sure, you know, and thank you very much for introducing us many very impressive initiatives in Egypt. I'm sure many people want to learn more from you in the future. Now, I'd like to ask Mr. Bill Woodcock, who is a founder and research director for PCH, to speak.
Hi. So I'm going to speak without slides and talk about the means by which internet bandwidth is produced and how it is that internet bandwidth makes its way to users, particularly as it relates to developing economies, since that's the sort of topic of today's discussion. All internet bandwidth ultimately comes from internet exchange points, and there are about 300 internet exchange points in the world today. The vast majority of these are in Western Europe, North America, the developed countries, countries of East Asia. Only a very few of them, I believe 17 in the African continent, 20 in Latin America, are in countries which are still sort of on the middle part of the upward curve of internet development. Sorry, I'll try and speak a little bit louder. It sounds like it was difficult to hear in back. The problem, of course, is that if, as with any product, if you're importing it, your costs are much higher. If you're a developing country with a currency that is not strong, and you have to import things from England or the United States or Japan, it's going to put those things out of reach of most consumers. So importing internet bandwidth to Uganda from London is not economically desirable. It puts that internet bandwidth out of reach of most consumers in Uganda. Same thing with, you know, internet bandwidth into Cambodia from Tokyo. You know, this is not a long-term strategy that will work. If we look historically, there was a time when all internet bandwidth came from the United States globally. Europe was the first to free themselves from that economic dependency. There were internet exchange points built in London and Amsterdam and Frankfurt, and now there are about 100 internet exchange points in Europe. A third of the world's total are in Europe. Asia has done the same thing and built huge internet exchange points in Seoul and Tokyo and Hong Kong. The developing world has been slow to follow, though, and this has, in an economy that doubles in size every year, as the internet has done for 30 years, failing to double in size in any year puts you behind the curve very substantially. And so we've seen countries that have not only failed to double in 1 year, but failed to double year after year after year. And I think Nishal will talk a little bit about what we've seen in South Africa. I mean, South Africa is a developed country. South Africa is a country with very strong internet demand. But, you know, there are ways of screwing this up, many, many ways of screwing this up, and very few ways of doing it right. So building local internet exchange points is the only sure way of making your internet access affordable within the country, within your own currency, within your own economy. There are two parts to making bandwidth affordable, though. The other is getting the cost of international bandwidth down. At first, these would seem to be unrelated things, right? That some of your people's traffic will be local within the country, some will be international. There's no real overlap between these two, or there shouldn't be. If you don't have an internet exchange point, however, all of your local traffic is going to go out through your international bandwidth and come back in again, in addition to whatever actual international traffic you have. So effectively, two-thirds of your bandwidth is going to get used for traffic that never needs to cross that bandwidth at all. So effectively, you're going to be tripling the cost of your international bandwidth by misusing it for local traffic. And obviously, tripling is a vast generalization, right? It's going to depend actually on how much of your traffic is international. But as long as your local traffic has to go out and come back in, it's going to be twice as expensive as international traffic that only has to come in once through that path. That means that there's a huge disincentive for the development of local content. And the putting of local culture online and local you know, literature, local news, all of these things are going to be at an economic disadvantage relative to international content coming from the countries that have the exchange points that only have to make one trip through that circuit. So there are big nationalist cultural advantages to this as well as purely economic advantages. The good news, just to wrap up and give Nishal as much time as I can for his more substantive talk, the good news here is that building exchange points is not an expensive thing to do. For people who are used to telecom scales of operation rather than internet scale of operation, in the old telco economy, you could have expected to invest many millions of dollars to get a few megabits of capacity. In the internet, we build tens of gigabits of capacity for a few thousand dollars. We have to in order to be able to do this doubling every year. So internet exchange points, except for a few of the very largest ones, the hundreds of exchange points out there in the middle of the spectrum, cost between, say, $5,000 and $50,000 to build. And for a national production capacity of a critical resource, this is a trivial amount of money. The even better news is that if you build an exchange point well, if you don't overspend on it, if you make sure that people in your country are actually using it, the payback time on that is likely to be 4 to 6 weeks. So there's really no reason not to hurry up and get that done. Right now there are more countries in the world that don't have an internet exchange point than ones that do. There are almost 100 countries in the world that have no internet exchange point, no domestic production capacity at all, and that have to import all of their bandwidth. So that's the thing I'd like to see people work on in reducing access costs. And with that, I'll turn it over to Nishal, and we'll try and get the slides working here for him.
Thank you very much, Mr. Woodcock. Your point to focus on both domestic internet exchange point and international connection sounds very important. And the next speaker is Mr. Nishal Gobahan from Internet Solutions in South Africa. Please.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. When I was first asked to come and speak about the topic that we're discussing this morning, I found it actually quite difficult to pick a point to start and focus on. Since so much has been said, and no doubt through the rest of this conference you're going to hear a lot more being said about what the essential requirements are for the developing world. And they're all pretty noteworthy items, like access to suitable education, which in turn is going to breed a skilled labor force, which in turn is going to foster improved service delivery options, and all of that's going to help to reduce the cost of doing business in a local environment. Now, I'm here today to speak from the background of an ISP that started off in South Africa and that has, for the past 7 odd years or so, been successfully operating in the United States and the United Kingdom, and more recently in local parts of Africa. I don't have a lot of time. We're trying to get in as much as we can this morning. So I'm going to talk to you instead, not about all of the issues that we possibly can, but about the single greatest factor that has been an impediment in my business's growth. The South African telecommunications policy. So until very recently, South Africa operated under a very restrictive telecommunication model. There was a monopolistic, largely government-owned telco that was solely mandated to provide all communication between public and private sector entities. And there were some notable exceptions, particularly in the case of certain parastatals. To put this in perspective, so limiting was the scope of the monopoly that if you wanted to do your high school experiment of connecting two cans with a piece of string to create a mock telephone, which I'm sure is something all of us have done, you couldn't do this in our country if you were going to cross a public road. It would be illegal. Okay? And that's the truth. The the monopoly is really all-encompassing. It covers telephony, it covers fixed data services, it covers satellite, and most notably, it covered the international landing points, the fiber landing points, where on the two points on our coast where the undersea cables touched and provided us with access to the high-speed fiber cables and to the rest of the world. It included that as well. So what does this mean for you if you were, like us, trying to build an ISP in South Africa? Well, if you wanted to set up operations, what an ISP would call a POP, a point of presence, any onward connection, that means any connection to your new equipment, any connection to your existing equipment, would have to be provided by the sole telco. And the sole telco would be in the position to dictate what they were going to sell you and at whatever cost. Now, this works not just for intercity connections, it would work for interstate connections as well. Literally, your one-stop shopping trip started and ended with the local telco. You've heard many times people say that bandwidth is the lifeblood of the digital economy, that without bandwidth, you can't grow your business. And effectively here, we're in a situation where any particular growth was being curtailed by the fact that we couldn't get access to our bandwidth. You'll hear as well during the latter part of this discussion that bandwidth is a commodity, that bandwidth's cheap and easy in lots of places, it's free, you should not let this be a constraint. Well, the reality is that in our part of the world, and even in today, in fairly developed South Africa, bandwidth is not yet a commodity. You can't really get access to the type of circuit speed that you would need to be able to perform most things that an average user would want to be able to do. And that's nothing really fancy. That's reading email at the same time as maybe watching a small movie online or even streaming an IGF meeting. Are we talking a lot about bandwidth? So, what are the costs? With its almost exclusive hold on network access, our monopolistic telecom was able to choose pretty much whatever pricing scheme it deemed relevant. If we submit that bandwidth costs have restricted growth of the South African internet community, then what you're seeing is a measure of equivalent costs. A recent study was taken between 15 countries that have the same sort of demographics as South Africa, and here I'm talking about the income dispersion, I'm talking about population dispersion. We know for a fact that we have largely populated cities, but large provinces or states that have very few users in them. So if you had to group South Africa along with countries like Morocco and Brazil, other developing countries, these are the numbers that you see, and this is what came out of it. We can go back to that later if you want. In country, current bandwidth costs often imply that it's cheaper to purchase and provision connectivity internationally rather than just point to point from city to city within our country. So while entirely impractical, for us, accounting-wise, it would make perfect sense to connect our Johannesburg and our Cape Town offices via London. Johannesburg to Cape Town is about an hour and a half flight. It's 1,400 kilometers. Johannesburg to London via Cape Town is much, much longer. In fact, in our country, telecommunications costs are a rising concern for the government and has long been seen as a barrier to doing business. It was most prominently highlighted by President Mbeki in his address in Parliament, his State of the Nation address, where he said that we have to get telecommunications prices down in order to attract business. Local is lekker is a phrase in South Africa. Lekker just means nice. And as Bill said, you really want to be able to increase your economy by increasing the amount of local content. Well, high bandwidth costs in country means that it's a lot more difficult to grow and maintain local content. I don't know of any well-defined accounting cost attached to the local end user that wants to retrieve information. With high bandwidth costs, it becomes incredibly difficult for someone to have to be able to justify to be able to house, for instance, a local news server in South Africa, where he can go to the United States or the United Kingdom and pay something like $15 a month to be in a fancy data center somewhere. With our costing, those models just don't exist. You get the difference between fast and cheap, and really, you only get to pick one. Now, without access as well to fast bandwidth, local bandwidth, down to the user, you also have severe service offering limitations that you can practically roll out. One of my favorite applications on the internet today is one that takes satellite images and allows you to navigate through a city or to be able to find your way, which is very useful. That sort of application, as immeasurably useful as it is to me, is entirely unusable over a low-speed connection, particularly if you need to cross the ocean twice in order to get that sort of content. So, as you've already heard, an excellent method to create bandwidth is the introduction of local internet exchange points, and that's exactly what we did back in 1997. We created Jinx, Johannesburg Internet Exchange. It's a currently active internet exchange, and it does about 120 megs through the shared switched fabric. That's all the people that agree to peer publicly, and we can draw statistics on that. And there's a considerable amount of traffic that goes through people that don't, for whatever reason, choose to peer through the switch and peer through their own private interconnects. The Jinx is ISPA endorsed. ISPA is the local Internet Service Providers Association. It's a trade organization made up by all the internet service providers to basically come together and stand united on issues. We've got international support at Jinx. We've got two DNS root servers. You've got to think about, as Bill said, an internet exchange as being a factory, really. And that's what Jinx is for us. It, between our peers, it produces, on my network, about 100 megabits of traffic a second. I don't want to even try to equate that what that's going to cost me in US dollars to pay for an equivalent circuit to connect to get content from, you know, either the United States, the United Kingdom, or Hong Kong, or wherever it's going to be from. But not all our internet exchanges were a success. A few years ago, we started and ran Synx, the Cape Town Internet Exchange, and that's no longer operational. It ran for a period of about 3 years. And there were different reasons for that failing, but the primary reason behind that was that there weren't enough participants. In order to connect to the Internet Exchange, you needed to buy a leased line circuit at the time to connect into it. And the cost of the circuit was too prohibitive. It was much more cheaper for somebody wanting to participate at the Synx to rather go to another ISP and say, listen, we'd like to buy transit from you, and by the way, can you give us access to the Cape Town Internet Exchange across the same path? It's sad, really, because internet exchanges are one of the few businesses in the world that don't really fail. I mean, Bill can probably tell you that there's probably been a history of about 20 internet exchanges that have not gotten off the ground. Put that against a number of about 300 odd operational internet exchanges, growing internet exchanges, it's minuscule if you've considered a business. But not everything's bad for South Africa. We now have a second network operator that's been licensed and is operational and providing services. In fact, my company has recently purchased a circuit from Cape Town to Johannesburg, that very expensive part that I was telling you about. And you can see the cost differential. International services for the second network operator, however, are still very expensive. So we can't go to the SNO and say, hi, can you provide us with a circuit from Johannesburg or Cape Town all the way into New York, London, or even Accra in Ghana? Because the rights for the landing points at the submarine station still belong to our telecom. That hasn't been released yet. We've got hope coming in for two additional cables that I've written down, Seacom and Easy, that maybe with the introduction of those, international prices will come down and make it a lot more affordable to do business. And one of the things that I'm particularly glad about is that now that local loop costs have been are coming down with the introduction of the SNO, Synx is being revisited. In the initial RFP that we did with local ISPs in Cape Town to find out if they would be interested in connecting back into the internet exchange at now the lower local loop costs that the second network operator is able to provide to us. We had very positive feedback. Everyone's favorite topic, WiMAX. Well, WiMAX for us is really the proverbial shot in the arm for local businesses. It's a quick and easy method for us to be able to get a lot of bandwidth very quickly to the last mile. But WiMAX is not a silver bullet, you know. You can't build a network based on WiMAX. We can use it to deliver high-speed content to the end user. So my application of drawing maps using satellite images, that's going to be able to work great. But you need to be able to have something in the background to be able to connect all your WiMAX high sites back into each other, and that high-speed backbone. We're successfully doing WiMAX testing. Our initial attempt at the license was refused. We're at it again, persistent as always, and our license is still pending. I believe that there's a decision due out sometime in the middle of December. There are a couple of reasons we did well as a company in taking into account everything else that I've said. And these are some of the issues that we did use to succeed. I have, you know, really to make a confession. In no small part, a large component of our business succeeding is because the local community are really quite tired of the incumbent. And people naturally favor the underdog, and so a lot of people would choose to come and do business with us than the local incumbent's IP provider. We're very active in community support. The Internet Service Providers Association, as I mentioned, is a body of all local ISPs that collaborate and work together, and my company, is one of the most active members there. We have a large footprint, or we had a large footprint, before the introduction of the state-owned ISP arm, Sykes. So, really, we have a lot to lose. We are constantly in court with the telco and Sykes, and it's a relationship that we need to keep because literally we must. We've got the most to lose, and really we can afford to. Now, I want to stop and mention that's really a bad reason to succeed. You know, the fact that we're large and that we can take the telco to court, whereas someone who wants to start an ISP that doesn't have the resources to necessarily do that, you just can't draw those comparisons. But it really is the reality for us. And then there's obviously the vanity factor. People want to be connected to a global ISP, which we are at this point, and a practical factor. It helps to simplify our routing. We were able to sell products like a QoS model way back in 1999 when nobody in our country was even thinking about anything like that at the time. And that's literally also been the other proponent for our business, selling unorthodox and unique services. Like overseas hosting, I mean, you've got this little ISP from South Africa saying, if you want to host a server in New York or London, sure, no problem, we can sell you data space. That's, you know, I think that's quite something. But a lot of that has associated costs attached to it. You know, we've had to build in complexity into our network. We've had to find sometimes really smart ways of doing things as opposed to what traditional ISP engineers would tell you would be the simple things to do. ISP engineers like to keep things simple. I know this. I'm one of them. We don't like complexity. We like predictable ways of something failing and working. But in order to squeeze the very last bit of bandwidth out of the limited services that we've had to do, we have special services in place in lots of components of our network, so that we can offer a value add, so that we can say this is a product that someone else may have said no to you, but it's something that we're willing to do it. And you know, of noteworthy is that a US ISP entered our market a couple of years ago, and they succeeded because they have a global name, and they came in and people wanted to buy services from them, but they had a product list. So if you wanted to purchase a service, they'd come to you with a product list and say, pick one. My business's mentality is, what would you like, and we'll build it for you. That's great. It helps us grow. But you know, if you've got 300,000 customers, you can't have 300,000 unique solutions at the same time. So with this additional service is increased complexity, increased operational costs that we're now being forced to build because we don't have literally the bandwidth in the core to be able to support everything the way we'd like to be able to do it. if I had to go back in time, back to 1993 when we first started, there are just three simple things, the three simple things that I'd ask for most would be more fixed line competition as soon as possible. And you've seen the numbers for yourself. It's 60% the cost to get a circuit in from Cape Town to Johannesburg with the second operator, with competition now being introduced in our environment, than it was with having no competition. I'd want an independently empowered regulator. If you want to argue that regulation is necessary at all and the industry is not capable of regulating itself, we have a regulator in South Africa, but our regulator's reporting path is kind of interesting. And I'd like faster access to lay our own fiber. You want to own the infrastructure. You want to allow business operators to say, this is how we want to build our network, and we're willing to foot the cost to get that done. And yes, we're ready and we're capable to do that now. Let us do it. Running a business is what we do. And I think given those three things, our business, I think a huge component of the South African ISP market would be very, very different today. So that's it for me. I think we're on questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Govahan, and for your comprehensive explanation about the situation in South Africa. Now, at this point, I'd like to open the floor for comments and questions. Please raise your hand and hopefully identify yourself before you speak. You can ask questions to the panelists.
Thank you. I think government helped to build networks from budgetary side and tax side and maybe local government side, but the total amount is very small, very, very small. And 98% of the construction is private sector, they did by themselves. And only just first stage incentive, it has some meaning of first stage incentive. That's only.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mori. Any other questions, comments? Yes, over there, that gentleman over there.
Yes, I agree totally with you, and I think what I was trying to say is that we worked on the both axes, developing the infrastructure and opening competition to provide networks and services that are at low cost from the infrastructure side, and at the same time enhancing the ICT demand by many things. First, allowing people to be able to access the ICT world. Secondly, of course, there were some initiatives. We have also, maybe I didn't have time to address everything, but the Arabization and the localization of content. Egypt has a big legacy in the media, for example, and in providing really local content to the region. And we are trying to work on this to enhance the demand side. Plus, of course, there are many programs on e-health, e-government. We had a digital signature law coming up, copyright law. We're working on this to provide also e-commerce. And we're trying to also enhance the provision of PCs in schools. There is a national program to help schools to be connected to the internet. So on these axes, we are working. And as I said, one of the success stories is starting with the e-health, e-government, e-education initiative, and so forth. And actually, we have a strong public-private partnership. So the environment has been driven by all players here. The regulator is doing a lot of effort in providing the regulatory framework, and the competition atmosphere, healthy competition environment for the companies and the private sector to provide initiatives and to provide innovation in this. And with the introduction of Triple Play and the mobile operators is a very successful story in Egypt. The growth was tremendous, from 13 million subscribers to 27.7 in about 2.5 years. So, and the 3G being introduced, and there is fierce competition between the three big players now in Egypt. And I think it's up to the industry to provide the innovation in this. The ministry and the regulator are just setting up the ground for the possibility of bringing down the prices, of playing the competition at fair basis, and so forth. Another thing also is what was said here, of course, on the internet exchange points. What we're trying to do by localizing the content and by providing a hub in the region, maximizing the bandwidths going out of the region of Africa, North Africa, and the Middle East, so that we can negotiate better prices on the bandwidth and bring the whole thing down. Again, bringing the multiple licenses in the competition in landing cables. This will allow also the prices to go down. So we're working on different axes from the demand side, from the infrastructure side, and the regulatory side. Thank you.
My name is Numajiri from the internet service provider in Japan. And I have a question to Dr. Olfat and also Mr. Bill. Actually, the company providing the internet access service for the domestic customer and also the IP backbone services in all over the world. And in Japan, the broadband, the number of the customer of the broadband is increasing, and the also, that was mentioned by the Mr. Mori. And we are facing some issue because the number of the subscriber of the broadband will be increasing. So that case, definitely the backbone, the capacity will be increased. And also, this that case, some of the contents is in the overhead part. And also, some of the customer, especially the corporate customer, using the internet for the VPN from the Japan to the overseas subsidiary like that. In that case, we should to consider the both parts. One is of course the last mile access, and also the backbone connectivity. Then the facing the issue is the part of the backbone connectivity because. In the world, some of the developing countries not allowed to increase, upgrade the backbone. So that case, we and also the our end user facing the trouble to feel the pressure and the it's cannot get enough the capacity. If you have some of the opinion or idea, let us know.
Yes, actually, it's a good point. What we started to do with opening competition is to allow the industry to provide the capacity needed. We allowed everybody to compete to provide these kind of services. And actually, we felt that an upgrade of the existing backbone or the fixed network is needed, as you said. And this is why we are addressing now providing competition in the fixed network. We have chosen to provide competition on the infrastructure, infrastructure-based competition, not service-based competition. So we want to maximize on the investments to provide a modern network, fixed network, because also in Egypt, up to now, the population is concentrated around the Nile Valley. But we are working on expanding a network of roads and everything, and there are many new cities being installed. So we are hoping to provide a modern network, future-proof, to be able to provide the applications of the future and broadband, at least to these new areas, plus opening competition in the old city, in the existing cities, to provide more bandwidth and affordable prices. So what we're trying to address here is to make people get interested in building, in competing for providing an infrastructure and a new telecom or information infrastructure at high speeds, modern network that is capable of providing all the what we hope for the future to the end users.
So I think that Japan, China, Taiwan, and Korea face a unique challenge that developing countries don't have to address. My friend Jeff Houston from Australia once characterized this to me humorously as the blessing of Australia being 9 months behind the United States, which meant that people in the United States had to pay for all of the R&D costs, effectively, of new equipment. And Australia would come along 9 months later and be able to buy that same equipment on the used market at a very low cost by comparison. Right now, because they lead the world in amount of bandwidth being delivered, and because of the aggregation factor of putting all of those 100 megabit residential circuits together to reach these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of gigabits of backbone capacity, there aren't routers and switches being manufactured with enough capacity to provide for future growth right now. And the reason for this is because, as many of you know, there was a telecommunications investment bubble which ended in 2001, 2002, and a lot of investors lost a lot of money at the end of that bubble. And what we saw in the wake of that was a failure to invest new money in the basic research on making the transponders that drive optical signal through fiber. So prior to that, we'd seen every 18 months or so a new tenfold increase in the amount of capacity that could be driven through a piece of fiber. We went from 10 megabits to 100 megabits to a gigabit to 10 gigabits, and that was the point at which the research ended. And that research and investment has picked up again in the last couple of years, but effectively, we've, at this point, right now, had that curve continued as it did all the way through the 80s and 90s, right now we'd be at terabit interfaces. Okay, as it is, we're struggling to get 40 gigabit interfaces. So this is a huge problem for the countries that have real broadband right now. Developing countries will always be able to buy equipment much more cheaply with capacity that exceeds their current need, and whoever's in the very forefront is always going to be experiencing that pain. So all I can say is that you're experiencing pain that comes with success.
Thank you very much. Well, gentlemen.
Good morning. I'm Jerome from Comcast. Yesterday in the IPv6 session, one of the obstacles to IPv6 was identified as how to interconnect IPv6 islands and how to bring IPv6 into the access network. So my question is for Woodcock about internet exchanges. State of readiness of internet exchanges with regard to IPv6, how could we actually leverage internet exchanges to foster the transition to IPv6? And the last part of the question is, do you see people coming to the exchanges with IPv6 with a different interconnect policy than the one they have in IPv4? Do you see a more liberal policy coming, or do you see the same policy coming?
Let me take the last part first. There's very good news there, which is that because IPv6 is below the radar for most carriers, the economists in the carriers have not yet started paying attention to it because it's so small, which means that if you want IPv4 peering with UUNET, for instance, your challenge may be quite a substantial one, but if you want IPv6 peering with them, you're likely to be able to just make a phone call and get an engineer on the other side who will say, sure, what the heck, I can do that. So now is a really good time to be turning up your IPv6 peering before the accountants start worrying about how to put competitors out of business by creating artificial scarcity. Right now, when the scarcity is not artificial at all, it's still easily done. So the question about internet exchange point readiness, there's good news there also, which is that it's very easy for internet exchange points to support IPv6. Essentially, all they have to do is go to a regional internet registry and get an IPv6 block allocated. Every regional internet registry has a very liberal policy associated with that that essentially says, sure, here's your IPv6, go have fun. And so there's no challenge or obstacle there. Of the 300 internet exchange points in the world, 50 or 60 right now are actually doing some IPv6. What you'll find is that the ones that have been doing it for quite some time are the largest ones in the largest industrialized countries. But good news there again as well. Particularly in Africa, the transition to IPv6 is being taken very seriously, and the fact that there's little obstacle has made a lot of the small African exchanges look at this as a way to kind of leapfrog ahead of countries that might have some more resources but also more momentum to overcome. So obviously, as with V4, exchange points are the site of production for V6 bandwidth and are absolutely necessary to overcome the problem of V6 islands connected by tunnels that you mentioned. Which in turn is necessary to give V6 performance the same qualities as V4 performance so that users won't feel as though they're being burdened by that change. So I think there's good news. Things are not moving as quickly as they perhaps should, but there aren't big obstacles in the way either.
Thank you. Any more questions or comments? Yes. Marin?
I was asked earlier by another government chief. telecom settlements model, where the ISPs completely changed their methodology of, so we moved from peering in transit, which is the payment model in the internet, to a telecom payment model, which includes settlements. That's one proposal that's being examined. Another proposal that is being examined is the role of ISPs and the role of national infrastructure. So my question to you, having just reported on what we're studying in Study Group 3, my question to the panelists is, for the least developed countries, do you see the suggestions that you've made and the examples of Egypt as a viable solution to even smaller countries and more very widely distributed small populations in least developed countries?
So my panelist, well, you take the question, yes.
Yes, you mentioned the what happened in Egypt. I think we should look at this from a regional point of view, having regional hubs and concatenating the traffic, local content, and try to negotiate better prices for international bandwidth on individual sides. You can also open competition for cable landing, so you can play the competition a little bit to get better prices. And of course, if you maximize the bandwidth in and out of a country, then you have better chances of having a better negotiate better prices. So this is why globally in the region you should be able to create nodes or hubs to be able to bring traffic together out and in the region.
So I think that the answer is a very simple one. There are just two components to it. One is domestic, one is international. The domestic one requires that you have your own domestic production capacity, which means internet exchange points within your own country, and the free ability to use those so that they're not restricted to some subset of the players or something like that. And the second is the international capacity. And there are a lot of misconceptions that have been spread around about how it is that costs get covered in the internet and how it is that fair sharing of those costs occurs. In the internet hot potato routing model, there has to be a level playing field in order for costs to be shared equally, and a lack of a level playing field punishes itself. So a country that puts up barriers to entry to overseas competitors who would otherwise come to that country and connect bars those overseas competitors from paying half the costs, and consequently, domestic companies wind up having to pay all of the costs of reaching international destinations instead of only half. So if you want to see continued exponential economic growth, all we have to do is continue to follow the internet status quo of economic model and governance. If you'd prefer to switch to a linear growth model, the ITU has lots of plans for you.
Mr. Gobahan, would you like to make a comment too? Yes.
Yeah, I just like to echo all of what Bill has said, really. Literally, you know, as we've seen locally in our country, the internet exchange points are really the hub of traffic. It's what generates it, it what produces, and it what spurs on even greater production of traffic. To address very little bit about the issue about the costing, you know, if you had to work on the basis of settlement, then what incentive is there for somebody to want to come to speak to lowly South Africa? I don't think that's a question that we want to ask ourselves if we're talking about growing the internet economy, really.
Mr. Mori, do you have any comments?
It's very difficult to explain in English, which is not my mother tongue, but I'll do my best to explain. As I said, Japanese experience, I said that one is national strategy is very important, and the second is competition policy is also very important. And Japan succeeded to reduce the cost of internet because of these two reasons. From these point of view, as for the developing countries, government or nation itself should do more about decreasing cost. That means funding or any other means will be introduced to reduce cost. And the other is just Japan succeeded. Unbundling and co-location of the facilities is very useful to make competition more and more. Those two things will be the key factors to reduce cost, I think. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a very good general question to all panelists. I think I can take one or two more questions from the audience. Yes, I saw hands raised. Thank you very much for your idea and the suggestions. The concept of international tax may be a very interesting issue for all of us to debate. Any panelists who want to comment? Yes.
I think we're fortunate enough that we don't need actually such drastic measures, because the economies can help themselves. For example, in developing countries, I'll talk about Egypt, which is not a small country or a very poor country. It's a big and the rapidly developing country. But allowing the private sector to work in the country, you introduce investments and you can take taxes and you enhance the economy in an indirect way. You don't need to go to a United Nations or something. And the people that are not even connected, if you provide the good business models and allow the competition to work, for example, now we have 27 million subscribers for mobile. All of them are using SMSs. And this was an application that nobody thought it would be used in Egypt, but the amount of money it produces, it's amazing. And such applications and the private sector and the companies working can provide such models to enhance their revenue and to be able to pay more taxes and to put more investments, to create more jobs and to boost the economy. So you have ways of really developing your own place. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really want to continue this discussion, but unfortunately the time is up for us. And I have to, you know, close the session at this point, since we are having a reporting session of all the access from 10 o'clock. Allow me to point out some of the key points raised here today. I think regulatory changes, especially for new technologies, can promote greater access to the internet. Government policy and initiatives do impact the successful expansion of internet. International collaboration, we had many of those, does help such success, and there are many opportunities for all of us working together. And obviously, private sector takes an important role here too. Now, please join me in thanking our speakers and the participants here today. Big hands, please. Thank you very much.